So this evening, starting at dinner, the retreat has the same structure as a silent retreat. That is, we have silent dinner, some meditation, and an evening talk. Then we have, after the talk, we have about half hour walking meditation, and we come back here for the final sitting meditation, probably a little shorter. Then not all, maybe all the way to 9:30, because I imagine, how many of you are just a little tired? Feel some tiredness, yeah. It's been a long day. Also long for us as teachers. Is this okay? So, what I have found from many years of trying to bring together what I was talking about as individual practice, relational practice, and more practice in the social realm has been very interesting. It's that the core Dharma principles apply in every area. It's been very interesting to see that. And probably I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But the basic principles, they have applicability wherever we want to apply them, whether it's just an individual practice where they were mostly designed for that, but also in the relational practice, in relationships, and then in the larger social realm. And I wanted this evening to talk about one very fundamental principle that's been very important for me in my own practice, my own understanding of how the practice looks at the individual level and at these other levels or other areas, at the relational and collective area. So the principle is one that I call combining committed action in any realm with non-attachment to outcome. So it has aspects of paradox. So if you have your logical mind saying, you have to relax a little bit. And it has a paradoxical nature. That is, we have very, very clear action, but then in a way, we let things be as they are after we've acted. So I call it sometimes committed action, non-attachment to outcome. That was, maybe there's a little better language, but I'll talk about this principle. In ordinary English, we would say, you do your best, and then you let things be as they are. In English, we would say, you let the chips fall as they may. And the poet T.S. Eliot said it this way. He said, ours is in the trying. The rest is not our business. So I want to clarify this principle and talk about it as it's found in actually a number of spiritual traditions as very, very central. I'll talk about how it is also the basis for our individual meditation practice, something like this, and how it can appear in these other realms and in the relational and collective domain. So I'll talk about what makes this principle difficult to practice, which is basically that we either get attached to outcome or we, for different reasons, stop acting. And then I'll talk about what this principle looks like when it's mature. And to help with this, I've really learned a lot from doing a number of interviews I did several years ago. I did a book that I'll have tomorrow out called The Engaged Spiritual Life. And I did a lot of interviews with people from mostly from Asia and the US and Europe. It's a lot of the world. who were deeply committed to acting in different ways, but also were working with this principle. So I'll try to explain the principle, give some examples, some stories. And I think it's very, very crucial principle for our times, because a lot of times it's uncertain whether we will actually have results with our action. And we can get, despairing, confused, agitated, and so forth. But there's something about our practice which says, basically, you just keep doing the right thing. You just keep doing the right thing, what you think is wise, what you think is right, even if you don't have the results you want. It's not easy, right? It's not an easy principle. So I want to explore this evening. There's another way of saying this that was said by the Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi. Some of you know his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. How many of you know that book? Quite a number. He said, even if the sun should rise in the west, the course of the bodhisattva is the same. The bodhisattva is the one dedicated both to awaken and to help others. Even if the sun should rise in the west, the bodhisattva's course is the same. That's another version of the principle. It's not easy, okay? And so maybe I'll start with a story. This is where I really came to learn more about the principle. So I was, for about 7 years, I taught in universities, conventional universities. And I have a doctorate in philosophy. And I taught in philosophy departments. It was the only place in a university where you can talk about wisdom. And I had some freedom to experiment, had people meditate. I mostly actually did not have people read books. Very, very little reading, but I had them do inquiry about their experience. So I had them do writing about their own experience every week. So anyway, so I was a young teacher, and I actually didn't look much older than the students, so I had to grow a beard to make myself look older, which I did. I think it helped a little bit. And I was teaching at a place called the University of Kentucky. And I was in the philosophy department, and they had me teaching a lot of introductory courses, mostly introduction to philosophy and ethics courses, which were fun. They gave me freedom to do them like I wanted to. Now, about 20 years before I came, when there was a negotiation about what the basic requirements should be to get a degree, to get a liberal arts degree, the philosophy department made a very, very smart move. They got an agreement in the university where every student had to take either a philosophy course or a mathematics course. And so the philosophy department became very big because there was a great need, because no one wanted to take mathematics courses. So they, I think I was, without that, I would not have even been hired, I'm sure. And so there were, all the, just large numbers of people would take the introductory courses, because what was the alternative? On the other hand, they didn't really want to be there, because it was a requirement. And so I remember one evening class, it was in the fall, I was teaching an ethics class. And I had a very large percentage of football players in the class. This is American football, with the helmets and a little bit like gladiators, right? And it's, anyway, I won't go into it, but you know American football?
Yes.
It's also Canadian, So anyway, you can imagine, this was during the football season, so they were practicing. And I went with them in the evening. So what did they do right before they met with me? Okay, they practiced, usually in the, they took a few classes in the morning, and then they had maybe 5 hours of practice in the afternoon, and then they had a really big meal, and then they come to my class. Okay, you got the picture? And what do they most want to do?
Sleep,
right, correct. What's the second choice? They can't sleep, because, I mean, they could sleep some in my class, but it was, you know, the second choice that they couldn't sleep was to just sit around and make jokes and not pay any attention. Okay, so I'm a very young, serious teacher, okay? So this is, this could be called, in relation to our afternoon discussion, a form of conflict. The football players and Donald. Okay. And so it was not going like I wanted it to go. And they would make jokes, and I was getting frustrated. I had a clear attachment to outcome, right? I wanted them to be serious, to talk, to learn, and so forth. And I was getting very frustrated. I didn't know what to do. And then I remembered that I had heard about this teaching from reading different texts, this teaching basically saying, act really fully and let go of the results. You know? So you, it's, and this can be, I'll explain more as we go on. It can be a little bit confusing as to what it means, but it basically means that you really try hard for your intention, but at a certain point you let go, right? You keep, the outcome is not in your control, right? And so I had read, I remember reading a text from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Maybe some of you have read that. And then there's a line in it where it goes like this: steadfast in the way, without attachment, do your work, victorious one, the same in success and misfortune, this evenness, that is discipline. You know, that was also the model actually for Gandhi. Gandhi used that same principle, very influential. And again, I have to bring out some of the understandings of it, because it can be misunderstood. It doesn't mean that you don't care about the outcome. You care about the outcome, but at a certain point you let go. So as you can see how it's related to a Buddhist teaching. And so I also know that there was a teaching in the Chinese tradition from Chuang Tzu, from the Taoist tradition, Chuang Tzu, Lao Tzu, which was very similar. There was a notion of what is in the Chinese is called Wu Wei, which translates usually as non-action. Is a kind of action based on inner stillness, you know. And there's this is from Chuang Tzu. He says, "The non-action of the wise person is not inaction. It is action, but it is not studied. It is not shaken by anything." So I remember this teaching, you know. And again, you can find it in different traditions. And so I said, "I will do my best. I don't know what's happening in this class. Some things are not in my control. I cannot control the football players, right? They, you know, the causes and conditions related to 5 hours of playing football and a big meal, I cannot control the causes and conditions, right? But I still want to do my best, right? And so I said, I'm going to do my best based on my best sense of what will help learning. And I just continued, and I relaxed so much. You know, and I still was doing my best. It wasn't like I gave up or was not doing anything, but I was acting without worrying about what I want is not happening, right? Again, I would try to be as intelligent as I could. I would try to say, I think, you know, given what's happening, this would be the best. So I still did that. But after I would do my teaching, I would just, in a way, let something go. I would not get so frustrated. And I was much relaxed, and I think probably much better teaching, right? Because, of course, You know, if I, and before that, I probably, you know, I know I had some resentment against the football players, right? Okay, and so it went on, and, you know, we completed the class, and, you know, I was knew I was doing my best, but I was content. I was balanced and content. I knew I had done my best. I wasn't sure what people, what some people had learned, but I did my best. And then afterwards, after I had already handed in grades, do you have grades at schools in Israel? You do, okay. So we had grades there. Not all American schools have grades. And I had handed in the grades, and they came to, some of them came and talked to me. And because the grades were already handed in, there was no, you know, strategy to make me give them a better grade. They came and talked to me and said, "We have learned the most in your class than in any class." So I said, "Oh," and I didn't say, "You could have fooled me," or something like that. I did not say some things, but I was very moved actually, and very surprised, and I have remembered that, right? In fact, I think at least one of them got in touch with me 10 years later, and, you know, it's all very sweet. So that was, at that point, I thought, this is a very good principle, you know, for times when it's hard, right? For times when what you want to do is not going on, so not going so well. You know, and as I learned about the principle, I found that it's actually in many traditions. You know, again, I mentioned it's in the Hindu tradition, I think the Chinese Taoist tradition. I think you can find a version of it in the Hebrew Bible. You know, think of the book of Job. I think it's close to this, right? It's really, the question is Job's faith dependent on everything going well? What happens when things don't go well? Does he still have faith in God? And I think the teaching in the Hebrew Bible is very close to this teaching, I would say. That, you know the story, right? Everyone knows the story here that, Job, yeah, I'm sorry. We say in English, we say Job. So it's Job? Job. Okay. So, you know, this is said from God in the book of Job. "There is one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." And then, of course, what happens? Things go bad, right? All of his children die, right? And he loses his health, he loses his money, and he loses his good reputation. And so it's a question, is his faith dependent, is his basic integrity and his beliefs dependent on things going well? And for me, this is close to the teaching. It's really saying that no matter what happens, you keep your center. Not easy, right? Not an easy teaching. And there's, you know, Gandhi made use of the teaching of the Gita for his own work in India. And so I thought I'd read a short reading from Gandhi. And I'll translate here and there if that's helpful. "The unmistakable teaching of the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, is that one who gives up action fails." So you have to keep acting. You can't, if you refuse to act, that's a problem, right? "One who gives up only the reward rises." So you have to act, but you then give up attachment to the results. "But renunciation of fruit in no way means indifference to the result." That's very important. So giving up attachment to the results doesn't mean that you are indifferent. It doesn't mean you still care very much, but it's almost like you do your best and then you let it be, something like that. "One who is without desire for the result and is yet wholly engrossed in the due fulfillment of the task before one is said to have renounced the fruits of his action." That's the technical language of the Gita. "One who is ever brooding over result often loses nerve in the performance of one's duty, One becomes impatient and then gives vent to anger and begins to do unworthy things. One jumps from action to action, never remaining faithful to any. When there is no desire for fruit, there is no temptation for untruth or violence. Take any instance of untruth or violence, and it will be found that at the back was the attachment to the end. That's Gandhi. And there's also a very similar teaching from the Buddha. Some of you know this teaching, and it's called the teaching of the eight worldly winds. Or it could be the eight worldly dhammas, is the literal translation. Tibetans like to call it winds, maybe because it's windy in Tibet. Okay. And so some of you know this teaching, I'm sure. This is the teaching about how we get knocked around by the winds of four pairs: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and bad reputation, and praise and blame. So this is a guideline. If you want to do this practice that I'm talking about this evening, these are guidelines for how you practice. You pay attention to how you get attached to pleasure and want to push away pain, how you get attached to gain and things going your way, and how you want to push away loss and things not going your way, how you get attached to good reputation and push away bad reputation, and how you really want praise and you get knocked off center by criticism. So if we were to practice this principle, and I'll come back to this in a little while, we would pay a lot of attention to these eight aspects, four pairs, and we would look at them very carefully, and we would set our mindfulness to really notice when these occur. You know, again, in any area of our life, in our meditation practice, in our life, in our family, or our work, or social action. Yeah?
Can I ask a question?
If it's a clarifying question, yes. If it's a deeper question, maybe save it for later. If it's a request for me to just clarify something, then it's fine. If it's a question about the meaning of it, or what do you think about this, and I will try to have some time for questions at the end, okay? Yeah?
Can you just repeat the
eight of them?
The pairs.
Yeah. There are four pairs: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, or fame, good reputation and bad reputation is another way to say it, and praise and blame. And these can be so influential, you know. For example, probably many of us, we're really, any kind of blame or criticism, we're very sensitive to, many of us, right? And I remember one time I was organizing a 7-day summer institute on engaged practice for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I was one of two or three organizers. And we thought it was going very well. We had about 100 people for 7 days. And about halfway through, we thought we would do an evaluation just to see how things were going and get some feedback from people. So we did that. We got a lot of responses. Out of 100, maybe we had 5 negative responses. All of the organizers just went right into the negative, right? Psychologists call this negativity bias, right? Where we just were so sensitive to the criticism that we actually lost perspective. Yeah? Interesting, isn't it? Is that, anyone relate to that? Okay, look around. A lot of hands, okay. So what's interesting is that this principle, I think, is also the basic principle for our meditation practice. That's interesting for our individual meditation practice, that it really, in a way, we have a dedication to keep on developing mindfulness and wisdom and ethics and understanding, right? And in a way, if we get attached to the meditation going this way or that way, we suffer. Do you know that one? You know, we think, oh, the meditation should be this way, or even maybe the retreat should be happening this way. And we can, you know, if we think of a silent retreat, we can look, for example, we get attached to having good meditation. So we have a phrase, we call them quotes, good meditation. Do you know what a good meditation is? Okay. What is a good meditation? Calm, peaceful, clear. And we often get attached to that happening, right? Oh, and again, it's very common. How many of you come to retreats and say, oh, I really want to have that meditation state that I had at the last retreat, right? Okay, if I just get there, it's all okay. So is it pretty clear? And how many of you have come to a retreat or come somewhere and wanted something to happen and not have it happen? And then suffered. Okay, so it's most of the group, okay? It's very, very common. And, you know, of course, we want to have, you know, this I think is a very good example of the practice. We want to develop calm and understanding and clarity and concentration and so forth. But the teaching is you have to do your best, and if you get attached to it being this way or that way, you will suffer, right? And you'll probably not get what you want. And so do you see how the same principle guides our meditation practice? You do your best always, and you try to be as skillful in your meditation practice, but at a certain point you have to let things go, let them be as they are. Does that make some sense? Do you see how this is not very different from what I've been talking about? Yeah.
What is to do your best in meditation?
What does it mean to do your best in meditation? We have one of the categories in meditation would be called right effort or wise effort. It's one of the components of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it actually gives a very direct answer to your question, right? Yeah, it would be, I think there are four components usually of that, and essentially it's to try to avoid negative patterns developing. In other words, try to avoid grasping or try to avoid certain things which are not skillful, and know what to do when you have difficult thoughts or emotions come up. And then the third, I think, is keep cultivating the basic qualities, you know, the qualities of awakening, like mindfulness and energy and investigation and so forth. So you cultivate certain qualities. And I think I interpret really our practice is moment to moment, something like this. We try to know what is happening in a given moment. Okay, so maybe we say, I'm sleepy, okay? I'm sleepy. Not what I want, but I'm sleepy. So we try to be mindful of what is happening in the moment, and then we try to say, what is the wise and compassionate response right now? And we just do that every moment. That's our practice. That's our practice on the cushion. That's our practice in daily life. That's our practice in social action. You keep asking, what is happening right now? What is a skillful response? Over and over again, on the basis of your best wisdom and compassion. So that's what I think. That's what doing your best means. We could clarify it in terms of skillful effort, and really just continually asking, even if it's things are happening that I do not want. I'm sleepy. You know, my back hurts. We always ask, what is a skillful response? And then we notice when we have unskillful reactions, right? Because we can really have a contrast. Unskillful reactions, when I'm sleepy and my back hurts, would be what? It might be saying, you know, I'm a bad meditator. I should leave the retreat. I should go home. You know, meditation is not for me. Meditation is stupid. I'm stupid. I'm just not a spiritual person. You know, the teachers are bad. You know, it would be better to go, you know, blah, 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 right? Okay, that's the alternative, right? That's, you know, we know what unskillful response is, or unskillful reaction. We know what that looks like, right? All those things, right? You know, we complain, we judge ourselves, we judge others, we make excuses to be distracted. We say, nothing's happening. I think I'll go take a 3-hour nap. Right? Could be helpful, but often not. You have to ask. Or, you know, I don't really like walking meditation, but I really like tea. So, okay. Is this familiar?
Can you clarify the point?
Can I what?
Clarify the point.
Clarify the
point.
The point. Which point?
The walking meditation and the tea.
Clarify about walking meditation and the tea.
I got cat with dog your examples. Can you clarify what you're trying to say? Please?
I'm trying to say that in any given moment we probably know what is a skillful response to the moment. The examples I was given when things are not going so well. When the things we think are not going well, and then is what is just a reaction, you know, which is like, you know, judging ourselves, judging someone else, saying, I don't care, just, you know, saying, just basically following an impulse, right, that sort of thing. Does that make sense? Okay. So I think it's helpful just to see how meditation fits that model. Now, the practice that we do, I think, in meditation or in really any area is, I think there are two main kinds of practice. We ask, am I acting fully? So in meditation, that would mean, am I really having skillful effort in meditation? Am I really doing my best in the meditation practice? Am I doing my best in this work and so forth? We can ask that question. And we can see the ways that we maybe don't act so fully. Maybe we get discouraged, we give up, you know, we judge ourselves. Again, in any area, we can know, when am I not acting fully? We know what that means in meditation, and we can ask, am I staying with my action, you know? Am I staying with skillful action? And we can also see where we get attached to outcome. You know, a lot of the reasons that we have unskillful effort is because we are attached to things being this way. I'm attached to my meditation having this result. And if I'm attached to that, when I don't get that result, I will react, right? And so if we want to look at how we get attached to outcome, we will look at those reactions. And again, the good model to do that are the 8 worldly winds, 8 worldly conditions. We would look at how I get attached to pleasure, how I get attached to gain or things going like I want, how I get attached to maybe looking good reputation, and how I get attached to people saying good things about me. So these would be, in practice, things that we look out for. This is a way to make this very concrete. Look out for those 8 aspects. If you want to do this practice, study the 8 worldly winds over and over again. Put them on your wall. Write them on your wall. Put them in your journal. And so if we find that, we try to be mindful. We try to work with that. We try to be aware of how that works. We try to be aware of how, when things don't go our way, we become reactive. And we have to study that, because this is not easy, right? This is not easy work. But through our mindfulness, we can really study our reactions when something doesn't go our way. You know, whether it's at work, you know, I have a plan, and the other people at work, they don't like it. How do I work with that? You know, I engage in social action, and maybe half the members of my group give up, right? They don't want to continue. And it's not going like I want. What are my reactions? Do I start blaming them? Do I give up myself? not easy, right? What do I do when things do not go my way? And we study our own reactions. And if you want to be effective in this way, we have to study our own reactions 1,000 times and get to know them. So how does that sound? We don't put that in the advertising literature. Come. Come to a wonderful meditation retreat. Study your bad habits 1,000 times.
I felt like I was waiting for the continuation of the sentence. When we know our reactions?
When we know our reactions, we're not so controlled by them. It's the whole basis of meditation. When we know our reactions, we can use different language. We have space around them. We can see them more clearly. We are not dominated by them. We have more freedom. We have more choice. We can, and you know, it's like a, you know, easy example would be a mountain climber often has fear. It can be a kind of reaction. But a mountain climber is very familiar with fear. So fear comes, and the mountain climber just says, "Hi, fear," and just keeps going. Right? It's like that. You know your reactions really, really well, so they don't dominate you anymore. And so this means that this is, again, you can see how, you know, meditation and retreats are so crucial if you want to bring this out into the world. Because you have to know your reactions 1,000 times or 10,000 times. You have to study them. That's how it works.
You mean pay attention to
them? Yeah, pay attention to them over and over again.
And then try to choose something that's more...
Well, the principle is that when we stay mindful of something over time, we learn something. Maybe we let go. You all know that, I think, if you've meditated very long. You study one of your patterns or your habits, and at a certain while, it can take a while. We learn. We are not mostly not quick learners. Sometimes you have to study it 50 times, sometimes 500 times, but 500 and first time, you say, "Oh, look what I'm doing. I don't need to do that." But after 400 times, you still say, "I'll do it again." Right? And so it's sometimes I call mindfulness the exhaustion method. You just have to study it over and over again until you're exhausted, and something you just says, "I don't think that reaction is a good idea. Not so necessary. I think, can I just relax?" Yeah. So let me say a few more things, then I'll open things up. So we have a sense really of how to practice. You know, we really watch our reactions. We watch when we get attached to outcomes. We watch when we somehow use the things not going our way as an excuse for not acting, whether it's in meditation or something else. So what does it look like when this capacity is mature? What does it look like? As I want to give some examples from people, some of whom I did interviews of, who had been working with this principle for 40 years, 50 years. You know, people who have been really exploring this. What does it look like? So I wanted to name a few qualities of this principle of, I'm calling it committed action, non-attachment to outcome. Again, there might be better language, but that's my language now. One of the aspects is that we actually are not so fixated on the goals. We are interested in the goals, but we also appreciate the process. You know, we also appreciate the journey. You know, there's someone in the U.S. named A.J. Musty said, actually, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. You know, that's really attention to the process. And so I think, I like to give examples sometimes from sports, because I think, you know, I follow some sports, particularly professional basketball, because, and I'm very happy someone here in the room has a Golden State Warriors t-shirt. Do you know that, the basketball team? There he is right at the back. And the Golden State Warriors, their stadium where they play is about 5 kilometers from my house. And so they are local heroes. And they some of them live not far from me. We see them sometimes at the grocery store and so forth. So, and they just won the world championship. I guess, you know, it's a little bit arrogant to call winning the championship of North America world, but that's what they say. I think they say that. Anyway, sports gives a good example, because often in sports, I know in basketball, often players know that they've done their best. And if they know that they've done their best, they're okay if they lose, right? I mean, they're sad, but there's some part of them that knows they did their best, and there's some degree of peace. Do you know that? Same principle. You can find that same principle sometimes in sports. You know, if you know that you've totally done your best, you know, other things are not in your control. And so another interesting way to talk about this comes from someone I interviewed named Dr. A.T. Aryaratne from Sri Lanka, who is sometimes called the Gandhi of Sri Lanka. And he started about 1958 an organization which is the most highly developed application of Buddhist practice to social issues. He basically connected it with village development. And they have in Sri Lanka, they have about, he has an organization called Sarvodaya, which means, let's see what it means, like, I think waking up together, I think is, I might be wrong about that, but they've, for about, I guess, 60 years, have developed about 15,000 organizations across Sri Lanka and 15,000 villages. And they were more effective than the Sri Lankan government after the tsunami about, you know, 10 years ago. Very, very effective. And I did a few interviews with him. I got to know him pretty well. He would come to the U.S. Every few years. He's getting older now. He's probably in his 80s now. And I did an interview with him, and this is what he said. When I do something with good intentions, and I quote-unquote fail, when I supposedly fail, I do not take it as a failure. So he's basically going to say, there's no such thing as failure, really. When I do something with good intentions, and I seem to fail, I do not take it as a failure. It may be a failure to others, but to me it is not a failure, because that failure may have taught me equanimity. I may have learned something from it. That failure may have taught me equanimity. What? Can I translate equanimity into Hebrew? What does it mean?
No, I know what it means. I just didn't hear about it.
Okay. Do I need to say anything more? Should I explain? You want me to explain equanimity? That's what you're asking. Okay. Equanimity means the ability to be balanced with whatever happens. So it's a fruit of our meditation practice. When you study anger, fear a lot, you get a certain, like the mountain climber has equanimity with fear. Balance, right? And so it's a fruit of our practice. Like for me, I've had retreats where one retreat I would have fear for 10 straight days most of the time. But it was not too strong. I was able to be mindful and just was able to be mindful of fear for about 10 days in a row. Same thing happened once with anger, even more intensely. I had anger. One retreat. I've done a lot of retreats, so these things happen. I had anger, I think also, this was 10 days, 18 hours a day, anger. But I was able to be mindful. I had very good instruction. I was working with Jack Kornfield. He gave me very good guidance. And after that 10 days, anger is never the same. You know? And this can happen in our practice. In other retreats, I remember other retreats, a lot of strong self-judgment, negative self-judgment. When you sit with this and can really study it, it's not such a big deal, not so scary. It's like there's a children's book, which I heard is also something in Israel. It's called in U.S. it's called The Monster That Grew Smaller. where that basically means when you look at something carefully, it's less scary. So does that clarify equanimity? So it means I can be balanced with fear. It doesn't knock me around, or anger, you know, or at least some kinds of fear or anger. Because that failure, says Dr. Ariadne, may have taught me equanimity or detachment or renunciation. So he's saying, when it looks like I fail, I can learn something. Another way of saying this is that if your goal is to keep learning, there are no failures, because you can keep learning from everything. And that's what really our practice is. That's another way of saying it, right? If your goal is to keep learning and responding as best you can all the time, then you learn from everything. And nothing is simply a failure, because you can learn from it. If things don't go well, you learn from it. So he says, that failure may have taught me equanimity. In learning to accept failure, I succeed.
Again?
It's a play on words. In learning to accept failure, in a sense, I succeed. And when you accept failure and learn from it, it's not really failure. It's actually success. Okay? Every action that I carry out carries an internal reason which is always beneficial to me. Another quality of this principle is that you keep your integrity. There's a way that you stay with your deeper values. You don't get knocked around. You don't, you know, and you really can learn to really stay with your most fundamental commitments, even if things don't go right. You know, it's very easy for us sometimes when things don't go as we want, we question our deeper values, right? And as we work with this principle, we have more deep commitment, more integrity. I had some examples, but I think I want to make a little room for questions, so I'll go a little more quickly. Another quality that we have as we work with this principle is we have better understanding of causes and conditions. So we see, oh, causes and conditions are responsible for whether the outcome I want actually succeeds. And sometimes I can do my best, but the causes and conditions are such that I will not succeed, or my social action does not succeed, but I still have done my best. So this is from Thich Nhat Hanh. He said, this was sometime after the war in Vietnam, because, you know, in a sense, he was active in the nonviolent movement in Vietnam for probably 15 or 20 years. Eventually, he had to leave the country for his own safety. And, of course, the communists took over, so in a sense, he did not succeed, right? Here's what he said. He said, the success of a nonviolent struggle can be measured only in terms of the love and nonviolence attained, not whether a political victory was achieved. And he says, there, you know, the causes and conditions in Vietnam were not such that there would be success, but still he did not regret his action. Yeah. That's not easy, is it? But that was his view. Repeat the quotation. The success of a nonviolent struggle can be measured only in terms of the love and nonviolence attained, not whether a political victory was achieved. That's Thich Nhat Hanh from Vietnam. Maybe one or two more things. So you have awareness of the cause and conditions. You often have a very long-term perspective. Dr. Ariadne, in looking at Sri Lanka, says, we have to have a 500-year perspective. The conditions that led to the civil war, for example, in Sri Lanka, he said they took 500 years to develop, with colonialism, other factors. If we want to look at how we can change it, we need a very long-term plan. So he said we have a 500-year plan. And he actually gave a very clear account of what that would look like. You know, some of the, you know, like 10 years just to get to know the people on the other side, right? Things like that. And so my idea is that we often have very short-term perspective, right? And so part of the quality of this is to have long-term perspective. And also to recognize that change is often mysterious. We actually don't know how change occurs sometimes, whether in ourselves, in people we're with, or in the society. You know, I was thinking of something like the end of apartheid in South Africa. Who would have thought that that would happen? And you can look at the life of Nelson Mandela, really follows this principle, doesn't it? He had, you know, he was in a prison, what, 27 years? And who would have thought that something would change, right? I'm sure, I do not think that he lost faith, right, from what we know. And so, who would have thought, if you were, I had friends who left South Africa out of despair and went to the United States in 1985. Who would have thought that just a few years later things would change? No one thought that, right? No one thought that communism would end, right? Or maybe a few people did, but no one I heard, right? So things are mysterious. And I'll tell a beautiful story that for me is beautiful. This is from, I heard from Daniel Ellsberg. You probably don't know who he is, but in the US he's pretty important. He actually lives near me, near Berkeley. And he was the person who was working for the US government on in Vietnam for many years. And he was very high up. He came to look at the all the reports, and he realized that the whole policy was based on a lot of lies. You know, and that this was very clearly documented in these studies. He could see that very clearly. So he decided in 1970-71, still the war was going very strong, he decides to make public these secret papers. They're called the Pentagon Papers. And he releases them to the New York Times. And of course, you know, the government wants to put him in jail. I won't go so much into that story, but a very difficult decision. He could have been in prison the rest of his life, if, you know, or maybe worse, right? But, and so he made that decision, but here's the story that I heard from him. You know, he made the decision in 1971. In 1960, he was working in Tokyo with the government, actually with a corporation called the RAND Corporation, which worked for the government. And he had a vacation, and he had read a book by Jack Kerouac about, called The Dharma Bums, which is from the 1950s. I don't know if you have that translated here. Anyone know The Dharma Bums? Oh my gosh, look at that. Anyway, one of my favorite books, and it has the hero of the book, is Gary Snyder, who is a poet and still very, very wonderful. I saw him about 1 month ago. He's 87, one of my favorite poets, and also an activist. And he had heard about Gary Snyder talking about this wonderful Zen temple in Kyoto. And so he went there. And he happened to meet, at the temple, to meet Gary Snyder, who was staying as a practitioner in Japan for, I think, almost 10 years, and doing Zen practice. And they met at the temple, and then they went out that evening to a bar. That's the kind of, that's more permissible in Zen than maybe in inside meditation. Anyway, that's what they did. They went out to the bar, and they talked, and then later, the next day, they talked further, and Gary Snyder invited him to visit his house. And Daniel Ellsberg said he was very deeply impacted, because Snyder was had a very strong, even though he was mostly a monk then, he had a very strong social vision, and very, 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 very clear analysis of world issues. And so he said that it had made a big impact, and that when he was deciding in 1970 whether to release the papers, he remembered the meeting with Gary Snyder, and it played a very important role. Who knows how things happen, right? Change is mysterious, right? You don't know. We don't know the effects of things often. So I like that story very much, because you don't know You know, you don't know your impact on someone. You know, we don't know how things happen. Maybe I've not done so well with time, but I think I will still want to have a little bit of questions. So maybe one other thing, another, we have this principle of committed action, non-attachment outcome. Another aspect when it's mature is that you can be with very difficult conditions for a while. You can be, when things are very hard, you still have your center. And so I gave one example. This is from Václav Havel, you know, who became president of Czechoslovakia. But you know that he, under the Soviets, he was in prison quite a lot, right? He was in prison. And he wrote about that later. He said, he makes a distinction between hope and optimism. And he says that, this is in English, or I guess it's in his native language, but optimism means that you think things are going to go your way, and hope is something deeper. So in his, the way he speaks about it, so this is what he said. The kind of hope I often think about, especially in situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. It is a dimension of the soul and not dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of this situation. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or the willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, regardless of how it turns out. That is what he said, you know. So that's another example. You can be with difficult conditions, it's like you keep your center, and you keep going, you can still be as intelligent as possible. So maybe I'll end with a quotation, okay? I'll end with this, then we have a little bit of discussion, then we do walking, okay? So this is from Vandana Shiva. Anyone know Vandana Shiva? Yeah, she's from India. And she is, I think, a physicist and also environmental activist, okay? And this was from an interview, and I'll finish with this. The interviewer says, every time I've heard you speak or met you, you've had so much energy, not only intellectual energy, but personal or spiritual energy. What keeps you so alive? Here's her answer. Well, it's a mystery. Because you don't know how you get depleted or recharged. But this much I know. I do not allow myself to be overcome by hopelessness. I do not allow myself to be overcome by hopelessness, no matter how tough the situation. I believe that if you just do your little bit without thinking of the bigness of what you stand against, if you turn to the enlargement of your own capacities, just that in itself creates new potential. I've learned from the Bhagavad Gita and other teachings of our culture, the culture in India, to detach myself from the results of what I do, because these are not in your hands. So it's the same principle, right? The context is not under control, but your commitment is yours to make. And you can make the deepest commitment with a total detachment about where it will take you. So it's, again, a little different language, but I think the same principle. You want to lead to a better world, and you shape your actions and take full responsibility for them, but then you have detachment. And that combination of deep passion and deep detachment allows me always to take on the next challenge, because I do not cripple myself. I don't tie myself in knots. I function like a free being. I think getting that freedom is a social duty, because I think we owe it to each other not to burden each other with prescription and demands. I think what we owe each other is a celebration of life, and to replace fear and hopelessness with fearlessness and joy. Thank you. Yeah. So it's 8:30. Do you need to go, or do you, I'm just going to do maybe 10 minutes of questions. What do you think? Okay. So I think about 10 minutes, but I'm going to be firm on the time because I want to have the 20 minutes for walking, then we come back. So we have one here and one in the back. Okay.
Can you please elaborate a bit more about the difference between indifferent and let the chips fall where...
Yeah, very, very good. Wonderful question. Can I make a distinction between indifference and letting the chips fall where they may?
With an example.
Yeah, maybe with an example. So this is really about, maybe partly about the meaning of equanimity, okay? And you know, that sense of balance. And in the Buddhist tradition, some of you know that there are four qualities of the heart: loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Each of them have a distorted version of them, sometimes called near enemies or near opposites. So they look like the genuine quality, but they are distorted. So loving kindness, the near enemy would be a kind of possessive love. There's some aspects that are genuine, but some that are distorted. Compassion, the near enemy would be pity. You know, kind of distanced. You know, you have a sense of, oh, this poor person has some aspects of compassion, but it's distorted. The distorted version of equanimity is indifference. You have some balance, but it's because you don't really care. Right? And so what's absent from indifference is caring. And so in the what I'm talking about, there's deep caring. You know, and you care, and you, there's the letting go is about, and it is confusing conceptually, you know, somewhat. That's clear. How should I say? You do your best, and then some things are not in your control. And so you really care, and maybe if things don't go your way, maybe you're sad. So it's really the presence of the heart, you know? So letting things, you know, letting the chips fall where they may, it doesn't mean that you're indifferent. There's still, the heart is there, and you really care. So, you know, you asked for an example, but is that clear enough? Yeah, okay. Thank you. So yeah, but it's complex conceptually if you try to think it out, but that makes some sense, right? So, yeah, please. Yeah.
You said at the beginning of the day, you repeated the question, what is our intention?
Yeah.
Isn't it a conflict with and not be attached to the outcome of our actions? Because we have a motive to, you ask, what is our motive?
Right.
If at the end of the retreat we will not get the motive we came from, that we will, you know what I mean? Because you asked.
I do know what you mean, yeah. Yeah, so the question is, I asked for at the beginning of the retreat, see what your intention is for the retreat. And the intentions might be different. You know, some intentions might be, I want to learn as much as I can. You know, and then at the end of the retreat, you have. There might be no problem, but if you have an intention, I want to really deepen in concentration, and maybe that doesn't happen, right? And, but, you know, so then it's really to see, did I do my best? And what did I learn? And so we set the intention, and then we do our best to make that happen. And also maybe we, you know, maybe halfway through the retreat, you change your intention. That's okay too, right? Maybe you say, oh, I'm not so interested in concentration. I just want to, develop more mindfulness of my patterns. You know, so the intention can change, but with the intention, you kind of go in a certain direction as best you can, but you don't always get there, and that's normal. So if you're attached to the intention happening or being completed, then it's a problem. Then it's more like the what the teaching is about. Watch out for that. So, does that make some sense? So we can have an intention without being attached to the intention being realized.
Isn't it will cause us to be less motivated? It's like we don't really take this game seriously.
Yeah. So the question is, if you're not attached to the outcome, might you be less motivated? I think that's possible, especially near the beginning. I think as you get more mature, you learn this principle. So at the beginning, you might say to yourself, I don't really want to have that peace that I had at the last retreat. And if you don't get it, maybe you say, oh, so much for this meditation. I will go, you know, spend more time on my computer. You know? And maybe you don't get what you want, and there's a reaction, and you stop meditating. But I think as you go more deeply in it, that's less common. So it can be, you know, the motivation at the beginning can be related to some attachment to outcome. And it may be even the energy for a lot of motivation. But it's not a mature motivation. So we have teachings that say, maybe you can develop in other ways. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Okay. I think I just have time for one more. Please, Satya.
What would you say to people like Krishnamurti, the old Buddhist teacher, who said that you should not but they didn't talk about against it. Activism or against acting, but they did say that the world takes care of itself and we're not really needed to make
this. This is, you say Krishnamurti? I wasn't not hearing everything you're saying, but I don't know of that teaching or that idea. I don't know of that view. That you say the world will take care of itself?
It's like,
I don't think when I get nothing, I know what you mean. I hear that teaching also where I go, and it's not the world will take care of itself, it's more like the world is what I have inside, that's what's outside. Okay? So, if that's what's outside, I need to check what's going in.
Do you have any idea of that? You mean we have to really focus on inner work,
yeah,
not on outer work?
Observation.
What?
Observation.
Sorry, I'm not.
Observation.
I hear that, but what about observation? You're saying that you just observe yourself? Yeah, no. I've sometimes heard that view, you know, that maybe we could say that you only need to pay attention to the inner world, and if you change the inner world, the world will change. Is that the idea? Or, you know, it's, generally, the view of acting in the world is not in all traditions or cultures. And I don't know exactly what is being said there, but there are a lot of complexities. For some people, sometimes at certain periods in their lives, it makes more sense to focus inwardly. I certainly did that. I was kind of an activist from a pretty young age, like from a teenager. And then when I discovered meditation, it was so strong an interest that I kind of went really deeply into that for a while and didn't pay so much attention to the world for a while. So there are cycles like that, that's clear. But Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's being said, so it's hard to respond.
Maybe
tomorrow, okay, because I think we need to finish, okay. Okay, so sit for a moment and then we'll go into walking meditation.